The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with us here, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at News Talk Science. If you don't subscribe to the podcast, well, do you know what? We always say, you know, do subscribe. We don't, for some reason, we don't monitor any of that. We don't, so we're not counting. So you know what? If you don't want to subscribe, that's fine. I don't know why.
Pretty much nothing we can do about it.
There's nothing we can do about it. And even if you, even if we have a million subscribers, we'd have no idea. So, I could just be talking to one person. So, and you know what? Do what you want to do. Coming up on this week's program, you may remember a few weeks ago, I was just sort of blown away by this idea that most vertebrates on the planet use bioluminescence, like that most animals glow. And that was weird to me. So this week we're going to hear from probably the world's leading expert on bioluminescence, Edie Wither. First though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio is Dr. Laura Dungan and Dr. Fergus McCullough from iCrack. You're both very welcome. Our first story. Have a guess what that is. You can text us in 53106. Laura.
Yeah, so this is a really interesting story about that sound and where it came from. So I suppose the history is that they found a mummy that is from 3,000 years ago, and his name is Nesyamun, and he was one of the priests in Ramesses, the 11th dynasty, which was in the 11th century BC. And they uncovered him and brought him to a museum in Leeds. And I think it's amazing. They moved him out of the museum just before it got bombed in the Second World War. And so he survived. And what they did was they brought him into a CT scanner and they took multiple images of his soft palate, of his throat, and of his entire oral cavity.
Because these mummies are extraordinarily well preserved.
They're extremely well preserved. This was rather unfortunate mummy because they believe he died because he was stung on the tongue by an insect and had an allergic reaction, which they think killed him. It's quite a specific, I'm not really sure how they know that. I know, it's quite a specific way to say that he died. But luckily he had his entire, all the bones in his throat were completely intact. Now his soft palate was totally rotted away and most of his tongue was shriveled up and gone. So when they were doing the CT scan and when they were 3D printing his vocal cords and his oral pharynx, they had to basically model those on current humans. So it's not perfect, but they do have a model, and they got an electronic sound and they pumped it through his vocal cords and they made that noise. And
so this is the voice of a mummy from the era of Ramses.
Yeah, from 3,000 years ago. And you know, one of the authors kind of suggested that if it were to be his dying sound, it would more likely be arg, but they think it's just the shape that his mouth fell into when he was in the coffin, the sarcophagus. But it's, in theory, it is pretty close. And one of the interesting things, I think, is that they found that...
Why say this is the sound of his voice give us a sentence at least. If you're going to extrapolate the hell out of this, why not give us?
I know, and everyone's really excited about it. I think it's like, in theory, it's really cool, but yeah. It's just a guy going, you know. And they do think from the shape of his vocal cords that they probably had higher pitched voices back then. So that's kind of interesting compared to modern men. But it's kind of just a noise, isn't it?
So here's a pop quiz question for you. Uh-oh. How do they get the brains out of mummies? How do they do that?
We know that via the nose. Yeah. With a big hook.
They get a little
hook. That was on The Chase the other day, says the person on maternity leave.
Is that right?
Yeah, it was literally a question 2 days ago.
Do you know, we did an interview with a guy who restores these mummies, and he did a project where he restored a mummy exactly the way the Egyptians would have done it. And they had found all these implements, and that was one of his discoveries, if you stick a sort of a hooky thing up someone's nose and then sort of spin it around, it liquefies the brain, and then you just turn them upside down and the brain comes out through the nose.
Oh, that is terrible.
Oh, that's not what I pictured. I don't know why I pictured it coming out as one piece.
I thought you could take it out with a spoon and eat it or something.
Oh, like, Fergus.
Fried monkey brains. Okay, our second story has to do also with a victim from long ago. This is a Mount Vesuvius eruption.
Yes, so speaking of people dying a long time ago, this is a fascinating story. So it all revolves around the body of a man who was killed when Vesuvius erupted in AD 79. But the really unusual thing is that when they went into the remains of the body that were sealed sort of within all of the solidified lava, that they found that part of his brain had actually vitrified, so effectively turned to glass. Now, usually what happens to people's brains when they get swallowed by an exploding volcano is that it turns to soap.
What?
Because the
that is not what I thought you would say.
The temperatures are so high. So they reckon this poor, unfortunate man that the temperatures are up to about 520 degrees, which is really, really high. And usually at those temperatures, all of the fats basically
burn
in that heat. They turn to soap and alcohol effectively. It's saponification. But what's happened here is that it looks to be vitrification. So the difference there is if things are rapidly heated but then rapidly cooled, you can actually turn it into glass. And that appears like what has happened to this particular person.
So, how much of his brain was glass?
Small little bits of the brain, you know, like it wasn't a perfectly glass two hemispheres that you could take out and hold in your hands, but it was small parts of his brain. And they also were able to look into that glass and kind of see the different areas of the brain. So seemingly the amygdala was quite well vitrified. So this particular study is out of the University of Naples, Federico II, and it's a group of Italian scientists. And they reckon that this particular man, he was about 25 years old, and he was found lying face down on a bed. So he died in his sleep. But they also think that he was the caretaker of a cult. Because he was found...
Extrapolation alarm going off.
He was found in a small room attached to a much bigger building, which they believe was the Collegium Augustalium, which was a building related to an imperial cult that worshipped the former emperor Augustus.
Oh.
So this poor member of this cult, not only was his brain vitrified, but also often what happens is when you get swallowed by an exploding volcano is that the build-up of
I love this show.
The build-up of pressure and temperature in your body essentially vaporizes your soft tissues, causes your blood to boil, and your head explodes inside your skull. So the poor guy ended up with an exploded, vitrified brain.
There you go. What a gruesome episode of the programme this week. Let's move to slightly safer territory. And Lara, this is a story about Rachmaninoff.
Yeah, so this is a group of scientists from South Korea, and it kind of upsets me. I sort of don't like this story because they've turned music into an algorithm and assessed it and had a computer assess it. So what they did was they got 19 composers from 1700 to 1900, and they fed their music into the computer and it broke it down into code words. So it's essentially looking at the different notes that are being played at the one time, and it's looking at the complexity, but more the novelty of them. So it wants to know who was the most novel composer of these 19 composers. And what it found was that Sergei Rachmaninoff, it's a really hard one to say, was the most novel of the composers. So he was the one who came up with the most new music that hadn't been done by anyone before. And then even his original work was quite different to his further on work. And then also...
I think that's a fair assessment. Let's have a listen to Rachmaninoff. This is some of Concerto No. 2. Now, because I'm not trained in classical music, that sounds a lot like classical music to me.
Sure.
But you know, obviously, but I think it's fair enough to say that innovative sort of music can be looked at in that way, because
yeah.
a music is extremely mathematical, and
it
if you
is.
Break those patterns but find new patterns. Isn't that an acceptable way to describe it?
It is, no, and I suppose that's the thing. If you qualify it by saying that it's based on novelty, then, you know, it's a fact, and it's a computer fact, and it is really interesting. But he wasn't by any means the most influential. It's pretty reasonably agreed that Beethoven was the most influential in terms of his music going forward, of all of the composers from that era. And Beethoven ranked right down somewhere in the middle of the bottom half for novelty. So maybe he was obviously just stealing a bunch of the good parts from everyone else. Which I suppose is every scientist in the entire world.
But there's exactly, yeah, you've got to, you know, there's lots of other elements that lead to someone going viral. And as we've seen, even today, going viral does not necessarily make you the greatest at anything.
No, absolutely not. But I mean, Rachmaninoff was the most original then, according to this algorithm, which I do think is quite cool.
And how does this algorithm work?
So it does things called code words. So it takes the notes that are being played at any one moment, and it analyzes the complexity of them and then compares them to the other 18 composers. And it looks to see which mix of notes have not been played at the same time previously.
Right. Okay.
Yeah, it's very
actually,
complex.
But actually, I can see how that would lead to.
It is very cool. Yeah. But I just, I hate, because they're saying they could use it for visual art and they could use it for, I'm kind of like, oh, I don't know how much I like this. But look, I suppose scientists will turn a hand at anything, won't they?
Our final story, Fergus, has to do with camo.
Yes. So camouflage. And this is all about if an animal is iridescent, is it camouflage? So if you imagine a peacock and it's got all its feathers splayed and you can see all the really kind of
shiny,
bright, shiny, almost metallic looking parts. So that's iridescence. So there's this particular beetle called an Asian jewel beetle, and its skeletons or the outside of it is really, really iridescent. And so the initial thinking was, well, obviously, like if a peacock is iridescent, it's to attract a mate. However, in this beetle, both males and females are both iridescent. So that means, you know, maybe it's not about mate attraction, maybe it is about camouflage. So what they did, this was a group of scientists in the University of Bristol, is they took some wings off these Asian jewel beetles and they stuffed them with worms. And then we had former wings full of worms, and then they stuck those onto leaves.
Uh-huh.
And there was two types of wings that they had attached. One were the natural ones that were very iridescent, and other ones were ones that they had artificially dulled. Okay, so they were matte. It's almost like glossy versus matte. They had them up in the forest, and they watched to see which of the wings, so the shiny ones or the dull ones, would birds target. So what they found was that the birds were able to find or kill 85% of the dull ones, but only 60% of the iridescent ones. Mm-hmm. So obviously,
the
iridescent
Jonathan's face right now
is some sort of camouflage. And it got even better. So when they put the iridescent wings on sort of hard leaves, almost like a holly leaf, which, you know, you can get a bit of a reflection off those, that the birds were even less likely to find them. So this iridescence is actually camouflage, which is really counterintuitive because it's so bright, it's so obvious.
Yeah.
Yet here, what they believe is happening is that
Just hiding in holly.
They're hiding in plain sight is what they're doing. So colour comes from pigment, but iridescence comes from structure. So what's happening is that the light is coming in, hitting off these tiny layers in the insect that are only separated by a small amount, and that gives back this glow. And as the bird moves, also the glow moves, so it's hard for the bird to actually see the beetle.
How many worms did it stick fake beetle wings on?
Lots, I believe over 800, I think.
Oh, okay, that's actually...
Yeah.
Because, I mean, I was thinking that's a very arduous task. They got 60 and 85. I'm thinking it's a multiple of five. Maybe they did only 20 worms. But that 800 is a lot. So you can actually probably... But it's not even that much of a difference. 60 to 85, maybe it is.
Yeah,
it
it's not that much of a difference. Actually, the biggest difference was when they released humans into the forest to find the wings that were stuffed full of worms.
Oh, I thought they were going to get they were sticking these wings onto people.
No. And getting chased by birds, no.
Yeah.
So when the humans were trying to find these iridescent wings on the leaves, they were able to identify 80% of the dull ones, but only 17% of the iridescent
17?
Ones. Yes.
Oh, that's something.
Do you know, it is really interesting how various scientists go about testing their ideas. It sounds ridiculous. But,
and justifying their existence.
But no.
I know.
You know, we should probably We should probably give right to reply to those scientists after hacking the party. Dr. Fergus McCall from iCrack and Dr. Laura Dungan on EcoEye this Tuesday, 7 p.m. on RTE1. Thanks very much for joining us. Now, the open ocean can be a forbidding place, not just in its vastness or raw power, but for the animals and organisms it hosts as well. It really is survival of the fittest, or in some cases, survival of the brightest. It's thought that on average, up to 3/4 of the animals in our oceans create their own light, a process called bioluminescence. But why and how? Well, Dr. Edie Witter, co-founder and CEO and senior scientist at the Ocean Research and Conservation Association, also known as ORCA, is probably one of the best people on the planet to answer that question. She joins me now. Edie, welcome to the programme. Talk to me about the way that this happens. How does a creature create light? And does it? Do they all do it in the same way?
So all light in the universe comes from the same phenomenon, which is an electron getting excited to a higher level and then falling back down and giving up energy as a packet of energy called a photon. And the only difference between different kinds of light is how the electrons get excited in the first place. So candle flames and incandescent light bulbs and the sun, it's thermal excitation. And so we tend to associate heat and light. But there's other ways you can get them excited. And one of them is with a chemical reaction. So you do that when you break a light stick. That's what's known as chemiluminescence. And bioluminescence is just a subset of chemiluminescence because it's chemicals that are actually manufactured by animals. And it's different chemicals in different animals, which is really kind of amazing how often evolution has come up with the solution of how to live in the dark, make your own light.
When this happens, does it cost a lot in terms of energy for an organism? Because when you get quite deep into the ocean, you know, a lot of those animals tend to not move around a huge amount. It seems to me that, you know, emitting photons is a energy intensive activity.
It is. It's a super, super efficient reaction. But they are very conservative in how they use it because it does take energy to produce light. There was one really interesting study done with a small crustacean where they starved these crustaceans and found that they would give up the ability to make eggs before they gave up the ability to make light. That's how important light is to sustaining their survival.
Wow. And that is, I mean, that is intense. Do we know why that would be the case? Because obviously, if we're thinking about evolution, passing on your genes, you would imagine eggs would be the very last thing to go.
Right. But if you're dead, you're not going to be able to pass on your eggs. So the first thing is to save yourself. So in that case, that creature actually releases its bioluminescence chemicals into the water, just the way an octopus will release an ink cloud. A lot of animals can release their luminescence into the face of an attacking predator, temporarily blinding them with light so they can swim away into the darkness.
Wow. What sort of animals would do that?
Oh, there's firefly. They're called sea fireflies that do it. It's a type of crustacean. There's copepods. There's squid. There's fish. There's lots of jellyfish that do it. It's a really common trick.
And the displays, as you sort of hinted, that they aren't necessarily flicking on and off of specific parts of the body. In some cases, it's the entire body. And in specific patterns, and other times it seems to be like a Christmas fairy light set, where there is a pattern going up and down that seems to imply some sort of intent for that tracing of light up and down a body. And sometimes those colors can actually change. Is that right?
So in a way, yes, they can. So it's definitely a language of light, and it's one that I've been trying to decipher most of my career. Yes, they can change color. In some cases, that's rare. But for example, there is a squid that can. A lot of these animals will use their luminescence for a type of camouflage, where they produce bioluminescence from their bellies that exactly matches the color and the intensity of sunlight filtering down through seawater so that they obliterate their silhouette, which is the common search image of many upward-looking predators. It's an amazing, perfect cloaking device, so perfect that if a cloud goes over the sun and dims the sunlight, they will dim their luminescence exactly to match it. And this squid, it actually carries it further because it uses it down deep during the day where its luminescence has to be blue to match the surrounding downwelling light. And up the surface at night, when they're counter-illuminating against moonlight, it has to be more green. So it turns on, it leaves the blue light organs on, but then it turns on an extra set of green ones to mix with that light, and it becomes a perfect match.
There are other fish that can move around the body parts like a torch, and others, as you've described, have headlights like a Lamborghini.
Correct. So some of them can actually roll their light organs that are under their eyes, like headlights, down into their heads when they're not using them. That's not to turn them off. They can control them with their nervous system. But they often have a reflective layer at the back of the light organ, just like you. There's a shiny layer in the back of your headlight to help direct the light outward. And they don't want, when they want to be in stealth mode, they want to roll them down so they can hide better in the darkness.
The counterintuitive thing here is that when these animals produce light, it is often to either repel or attract. Talk me through instances where light would be used to attract and the opposite, where they would be used to fight away or scare away predators.
Well, one that's absolutely spectacular that people can actually see, if they don't even have to be scuba divers, they can just do this skin diving in the Caribbean. There are these sea fireflies that I mentioned. They're about the size and appearance of a sesame seed. They're called ostracods. And they squirt out their luciferin and luciferase along with a little dab of mucus. And so it forms a little glowing ball, a pearl hanging in the water. And then they swim up and they do another one and another one and another one. And actually, the spacing of those dots is species specific. I had a diver once describe the appearance of this to me, because they do it all together about 15 to 30 minutes after sunset. As looking like champagne bubbles coming up through the water. He had no idea what he was seeing. In fact, he thought he might be having some kind of hallucination. But it's absolutely beautiful. But the point of it is that it's the males that are doing that. That's why they're called sea fireflies. And the female knows that if she goes to the head of that line, she can find a male of her own species that she can mate with. But the clever thing about this is they are producing light, but they're producing it out of their bodies as an attractant, but it's not going to attract a predator because the predator will go to the light instead of to where the female knows to go to find the male in the dark. That's pretty sneaky.
Wow. That's an extraordinary adaptation, isn't it?
Yes, it absolutely is. And then, but if a fish comes along and does manage to snag an ostracod, which sometimes happens around sunset because there's still enough light that they might be able to see them, and they snag one, the ostracod spews out this amazing cloud of luminescence that comes coming out of the gills of the fish, and the fish immediately spits it out because it's now making itself visible to its predators. So it's both a sexual attractant and a defense for the ostracods. And for humans, it turns out it's also a very useful chemistry. During World War II, the Japanese used to harvest ostracods, sun-dry them on a dock, and then Japanese soldiers would carry them in a vial with them in the field. If they needed to read a map at night under cover of darkness, they'd just spew a few of these into their palm of their hands, spit, grind it up a little, and there was enough light to read a map by.
You're kidding. That is a lot of light.
It is a lot of light, yes. It's impressive amount of light.
Wow. And do you know, I've been doing this program for 10 years and I'm always amazed by how little I seem to know of subjects that are absolutely fascinating to me. I'm like, how does everyone not know this?
Well, it's particular. I know that was rhetorical, but it's particularly amazing that we don't know it, given that we live on an ocean planet. this is most of our planet where this kind of thing is going on, and we're just completely unaware.
What are the reasons why a fish would bioluminesce to protect itself?
There, as I said, there are a few fish that actually can squirt their luminescence out. And so then it's pretty obvious how they're using it, which is to distract a predator. But then there is this thing that's called a bioluminescent burglar alarm. It's the same reason you have a burglar alarm on your car. The flashing lights and blaring horn are meant to attract attention. For you, it's for the police that'll hopefully come and take the burglar away, or the noise and lights will scare him away before the police come, but your car will be saved. The same is true for these animals. If they use luminescence for mating or for finding food or, you know, other functions, they'll use every light organ they have, if they're caught in the clutches of a predator, to attract attention of a larger predator that may attack their attacker, and therefore afford them an opportunity to escape.
It's smart is the wrong word, obviously, because they have evolved these traits to adapt to their environment, but it does feel extremely smart. I wanted to hear more about your research, because I know that you have brought man-made light-fitted machines down to the bottom of the ocean to try and interact with species who bioluminesce. Can you tell us a little bit about that research?
So I figured if I was going to be able to figure out anything about this language of light, I needed to be able to observe it in the natural state. And that's a real problem, because these animals live in darkness. And, you know, our way of knowing about life in the ocean is either to drag nets behind ships, and I defy you to name any other branch of science that still is so dependent on hundreds of year old technology, or we go down with submersibles or remote operated vehicles that have bright, bright lights and very noisy thrusters, and clearly we're scaring animals away. So the first thing I wanted to do was develop a camera that was unobtrusive that I could leave on the bottom of the ocean. And it had been tried quite a bit, but the challenge is that red light disappears so quickly in seawater, and red is the color that most of these animals don't see. Infrared just disappears instantly. You can't use it at all. That it just had proven unsuccessful in previous attempts. But I used these super intensified cameras to be able to record bioluminescence. So I combined that with red light illumination. But even then, I was struggling because I could tell the animals were still seeing the red light. So I got inspiration from a deep sea bioluminescent fish called the stoplight fish, that actually is unusual in that it has red bioluminescence. And it's unlike most deep sea inhabitants, can actually see red light, not just blue light, but red light. And so it uses its bioluminescence like a sniper scope. And I had measured that light organ and realized that it had a filter over it that blocked out all the shorter wavelengths. And so I imitated that filter, and I ended up getting a camera system that was unobtrusive. And then I could start testing different types of optical lures that imitated certain types of bioluminescent displays. So the one that I did first was what we call the electronic jellyfish, which imitates a very common deep sea jellyfish that has one of the most spectacular bioluminescent displays I've ever seen. So it has these ring of lights around its umbrella, and it goes around like a pinwheel. And it's so incredibly impressive and bright. You know it's got to be a burglar alarm. It's got to be meant to attract attention. So I wanted to test that. And the first time we were able to test it was on an expedition in the Gulf of Mexico. And I put the camera system down. And I had 4 hours of recording where I was just absolutely over the moon, because I could tell the fish weren't being disturbed by my red lights. It was perfect. And then 4 hours into the deployment, I turned the electronic jellyfish on for the first time. And 86 seconds after I turned it on for the first time, we recorded a squid over 6 feet long that was completely new to science. Could not even be placed in any known scientific family. I could not have asked for a better proof of concept.
Wow. And this, did this squid, this, you could see this squid because it bioluminesced or because of the nature of your camera?
I could see the squid because of the red light illumination that I was using, and it wasn't scared off because it couldn't see that red light.
Right, so it was kind of like a dark room.
Right.
Technology. Right. Okay. What do you think we might be able to do with this knowledge? I don't particularly think we need to. I think obviously science for learning about our planet is important, but are there things that we could do by understanding bioluminescence better?
Oh my goodness, we've already done them. Bioluminescence has had an enormous impact on biomedical research. So the chemicals isolated from these animals have proved enormously useful. The Nobel Prize in Chemistry was awarded in 2008 for discovery of a chemical isolated from a bioluminescent jellyfish called green fluorescent protein that has transformed cell biology.
Yeah.
In fact, it's the reason the Nobel Prize was awarded was because its discovery was equated to the invention of the microscope in terms of the impact that it's had. It's worked as a reporter gene. It's turned on, turned on a light inside cells so that we can understand so many things about cell biology that we did not understand before. And that's only one example. There are many other chemicals that have been isolated. They've been used to track pathogens in bodies. So it used to be that when we were trying to understand how disease or cancer progressed through animal models, you'd have to kill hundreds and hundreds of mice or rabbits or whatever you were using to look at each stage. But because now we can light up the tumor, we can track it in one animal through the entire process and figure out if the cancer drugs that they're testing against it are working or not without killing the animal to find out.
I know that people will want to see some of these visuals. If you want to watch Edie's TED talk from a few years back, it's on our Twitter page, twitter.com/newstalkscience. You can follow Edie at Edie Witter or at Team Orca. Edie, thank you so much for joining us. That was fascinating.
Thank you, Jonathan.
All right, it's time to look back at your emails and texts and tweets from last week. We were speaking about whale song and how whale song has dropped three pitches and nobody knows why. Michael says, could it be their populations are increasing so they don't have to sing so loudly? Yes, that is something that is being investigated. And Fabian Lee says, fascinating in piece on blue whales. Incredible to see off our south coast. I've never seen a blue whale. I've seen orcas up in up near off the coast of Norway, which is amazing. I saw fin whales, but I've never seen a blue whale. I'd love to see a blue whale. And you know what? Every year I say, around summertime, I say, why don't we go and have a chat with the, like it's a shark and whale preservation / enthusiast / research group. Who do, whale and dolphin? I don't know. Anyway, I always say, we should go on a boat with them. And then we do it. And then we find out they actually have to be on a boat for a long time. And then it's like, oh, I've got summer holidays. And it just never worked out. I'd like to do it, though. Let's try it again, Aiden.
Okay.
Ba-ba-bum. Let's do it all over again. And last week we talked about FameLab, the British Council's large science communication competition. Spans many countries and culminates in the Cheltenham Science Festival. If you want to find out more, britishcouncil.ie/FameLab. And we got an email in from Chris Power, who's from St. Gerald's DLS College in Castlebar, County Mayo, saying, hi, everyone. I'm a post-primary teacher, long-time listener to the program. I'm writing because not enough is being done to highlight the importance of science and reason, more specifically to reach our youth. Now, I'll respond to that in a while. But anyway, he says, while competitions like FameLab are great, they promote science in a more accessible way. The audience is limited. While it's right to give a platform to third level students of science, the majority of those have already opened their mind to science. Hence, they're studying it. It's preaching to the choir. I believe young people, children and teenagers need to be reached early on. While the young scientist allows them to do it, the event lacks the ability to reach out and communicate these ideas, especially to those who need it. Not sure about that either, but continues. You can study science, but unless you want to go off to college, a lot of the time students tend to view science as a foreign language or like Shakespeare. It doesn't have any real benefit. Which brings me to my suggestion to make a FameLab style competition for secondary school and promote the idea that science is for everyone. I'm aware that second level students typically are not doing their own groundbreaking research, but they can't. That doesn't mean they can't give a charming, funny or engaging speech. And what would the competition look like? Well, we did it ourselves. So I should point out that the FameLab logo is a copyrighted image that you have robbed Chris, but I don't think they'd mind because it's a great initiative. He's actually done this with 18 of his students and actually done a mini post-primary FameLab, essentially, and had lots of students kind of pitch a science talk, which I think is a fantastic idea. I do, however, believe that A, it's really important for third level institutions to take part in these, and it's not necessarily about spreading the word of science, but it's giving scientists the tools to then inspire younger people. So that's what FameLab is about building the skill set of storytelling so that they can inspire, so that the audience, the end audience is often young people, but it's about training those scientists to be better communicators from the outset. So I do think it's not preaching to the choir. That's not the point of it. And then if you go to the young scientists, you know, they are all really well drilled on how to talk about their science. So I think there is that communication part is a big part of BT Young Scientists, at least in my experience. But the more the merrier, and it's great to see that you've taken this initiative with your kids. I do know that the British Council has already started a school's version of FameLab in the UK and is trialling that. Whether or not that reaches these shores or internationally and goes on to continue, I'm not entirely sure. It may have gone beyond the UK now, but I think it's a great idea. I will put it to the powers and see whether or not there is willingness to try it at a post-primary level. But I think you're absolutely right. There is so much work that goes into the BT Young Scientist, and it's fantastic, but it is a big undertaking by both teachers and students. And for me, communication, as someone who trains people on communication day in, day out, being able to communicate an idea goes well beyond just science. It's what we spend our lives doing. We want a new job. We want a promotion. We want a date. We've got to convince someone on how to do that. So I think a young FameLab or an equivalent is a fantastic idea, and doesn't require the same investment of time. It takes you researching a topic that's interesting in you and then thinking about how to tell this as a story. I think that's a pretty good idea. Anyway, in summary, great idea, Chris, and congratulations. And I will have a chat and I'll send this on to the folks in the British Council who run FameLab, and I'm sure they'd be thrilled to know, despite the piracy, that you've been inspired by the programme to do more at a younger level. That's great. That's it from us for this week. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, who's producing, researching with Simon Keane on sound, Jojo Cardozo. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed over the next week. In the meantime, stay curious.